From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the secret talks between Israel and Jordan that led to last week's accord. We talk with New York Times reporter Tom Friedman, who co-wrote a special report on the secret talks. He's been writing about the Middle East for about 20 years. Also today, we talk with South African writer Sindhuwe Magona. She experienced the inequities of the apartheid system of education as a student, a teacher, and a parent. Her dream was to get a real education. When she was in her early 40s, she won a scholarship to Columbia University. She now lives in New York and is a translator at the UN. And TV critic Deva Bianculli reviews the new documentary series about Watergate, which premieres on the Discovery Channel this Sunday. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The White House says it may go ahead and lift the arms embargo on Bosnia all by itself. A spokeswoman says acting without the support of U.S. allies would be a last resort, but she says pressure could build to the point where the United States would be forced to act. More members of Congress are pressing President Clinton to lift the ban, and critics of the embargo say it favors Bosnian Serbs over the Bosnian government. The United States is pressuring the Serbs to accept an international peace plan, but they've now rejected it for a third time. Yugoslavia says it'll cut all ties that it has with the Bosnian Serbs as a result. An abortion protest in Fort Wayne, Indiana, ended without incident today. It's the first nationally organized demonstration since last week's shooting deaths at a Florida clinic. Dan Dreyer of member station WBNI reports.
Today's national prayer vigil was set up as a peaceful protest months ago. Local Operation Rescue Director Wendell Brain said the more violent members of the anti-abortion movement were not welcome today.
People are seeing today is the mainstream pro-life movement. It's not Paul Hill, it's not Shelley Shannon, it's not Michael Griffin, it's not those people who use deadly force. It is just normal Christian men and women here on the streets praying.
Federal marshals and local police had prepared for mass arrests but took away none of the more than 500 people who gathered downtown. 14 abortions were performed today. Operation Rescue plans more activities through Saturday, but no further action this week at the clinic. For National Public Radio, I'm Dan Dreyer in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Chicago will host the 1996 Democratic National Convention. It's the first such political gathering there since anti-war protesters clashed with police in 1968. UPI's Jay Saper has this report.
This city outbid the others for the convention and made the Democrats an offer they didn't refuse. A brand new convention center near a block of hotels. But it had another high card. DNC Chairman David Wilhelm is a Chicagoan who managed Mayor Daley and President Clinton's campaigns.
It is the capital of the Midwest, the center of the heartland states, states that we must win again in 1996 in sending our president back to the White House.
This ends Chicago's bid to host the 96 GOP convention. Mayor Daley said the city's come a long way from 1968 when his father turned police loose on demonstrators. Jay Saper, Chicago.
Baseball players are holding to their planned August 12th strike date. Union Chief Donald Fair says union officials have decided not to change their plans. The officials held a conference call today to consider an immediate strike. This was triggered after baseball team owners refused to make an expected payment of nearly $8 million to the players' pension fund. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 21 points at 37.71. This is NPR. The Nigerian Labor Congress has called off a general strike. This was intended to pressure the military government to release opposition leader Moshood Abiola. Cindy Shiner of African News Service reports.
2 days into a general strike, the Nigeria Labor Congress called off its work stoppage, saying it wanted to facilitate negotiations with the military government. However, a union spokesman said its 41-member industries would resume the strike if the regime didn't, by Saturday, guarantee the release of Moshood Abiola. He's widely believed to have won elections last year that the military annulled. He declared himself president on the election anniversary and was jailed on treason charges. Abiola's detention has sparked widespread unrest in his home region in the south, including the largest city, Lagos. A month-long strike by oil workers pressing for his release has further aggravated the situation with fuel shortages. Oil exports have also dropped, causing international petroleum prices to rise. Nigeria is Africa's largest oil producer. For National Public Radio, I'm Cindy Shiner in Lagos.
The House is responding to President Clinton's call to work as long as necessary to pass a health care bill. Majority Leader Richard Gephardt says lawmakers will start debating the issue on August 15th and end on the 19th. The chamber was supposed to start its summer recess on the 12th. The main Democratic plan in the House would require businesses to pay 80% of employee insurance costs. A scaled-back measure is working its way through the Senate. President Clinton starts nightly television broadcasts from the Oval Office this evening. He'll urge Americans to get behind health care reform. The chief aide to First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton is disputing a claim about a statement she might have made about Whitewater. Margaret Williams, Mrs. Clinton's chief of staff, says she never said the First Lady was paralyzed over Whitewater. Williams says she does not remember ever saying that to Roger Altman, the deputy treasury secretary. Williams is testifying before senators who are looking into the Whitewater affair. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Yesterday, King Hussein of Jordan flew his jet over Israel to demonstrate the new state of peace between the two countries. It was the first time a Jordanian plane was allowed in Israeli airspace since the formation of the country 46 years ago. The state of war between Jordan and Israel formally ended last week in Washington, D.C., when King Hussein and Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin signed an accord. The agreement was the result of over a year of secret meetings between the two leaders. New York Times reporter Tom Friedman co-wrote a special report about these secret talks. Friedman has been writing about the Middle East for about 20 years and is the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book From Beirut to Jerusalem. Friedman says the agreement between Israel and Jordan had to wait for the Israeli PLO accord to happen.
King Hussein really needed the incentive of seeing his archenemy and longtime rival, Yasser Arafat, make peace with Israel, be showered with economic aid from all over the world, and in effect steal a march on him in the effort to win control of the West Bank and the holy sites, the Muslim holy sites in East Jerusalem. That, you know, King Hussein has been a lifelong fence sitter, and he needed that incentive to finally get off the fence and come down on the side of making a full, open, and formal peace with Israel.
You write that when the king found out about the Israeli PLO accord, which had been negotiated in secret, he was thunderstruck, and that for 25 years he'd counted on Israel to control the PLO for him, at least in the West Bank. Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is that he never dreamt that Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat would ever bury the hatchet. And as long as they didn't bury the hatchet, Israel would continue to occupy the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And therefore, Israel would basically have a chokehold over the PLO in those areas. And therefore, the PLO would never really have a base of operations on Jordan's border with which it could threaten Jordan. Remember, in 1970, the PLO tried to take over Jordan. And King Hussein, of course, has never forgotten that. 80% of King Hussein's population are Palestinians. And the last thing he wanted was a Yasser Arafat with any sort of independent base of operation on his border. And the last thing he ever dreamt was that Yitzhak Rabin, the Prime Minister of Israel, would give it to him.
So is the agreement between Jordan and Israel bad news for Arafat?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Jordan and Israel are like the two arms of a nutcracker. And Yasser Arafat is the nut in between. And the sound you are going to hear out of the Middle East for the coming years is going to be the nutcracker suite.
And, what are they going to do to him?
Basically, they're going to play pickle in the middle. They're going to squeeze him. And they're going to make sure that he doesn't get out of his box in Gaza and Jericho, or they're certainly going to try.
Now, why did the talks between Jordan and Israel have to be a secret?
When King Hussein or even Yasser Arafat cuts a deal with Israel, there's trade-offs. He gives up certain things, he gets certain things. When you do this in public, though, some days reporters only write about the things you're giving up, and only later it becomes clear what you're getting. So in each case, they wanted to cut the whole deal in secret and then be able to announce to their people, look what I got, spin it their own way, rather than having it come out in dribs and drabs.
Now, did you have any idea that these secret talks were happening?
No, I did not.
So they really were secret.
Yeah, they were secret. I mean, there were little reports here. Rumor has it that Rabin met with Hussein here or in London or in Aqaba. So, you know, in all of these, where there's smoke, there tends to be fire. But, you know, the substance of these negotiations, the fact that they were going as far as they did, certainly was a surprise to me and I think to most people.
It wasn't an American mediator who was responsible for bringing these two parties together. It was actually the deputy director of the Mossad, Israel's secret intelligence. Do you know why he was the one who arranged the secret contacts between King Hussein and Yitzhak Rabin?
Well, the reason is that this man, the deputy director of the Mossad, happens to be a longtime acquaintance of King Hussein's. In fact, they have a relationship going back 25 years, which gives you some inkling for the secret nature, I mean, the depth of the secret relationship these two countries have had. He is, we were told, the most trusted Israeli to King Hussein. And it's this man who has really arranged all of the secret contacts between Israel and Jordan. He evidently has been and remains in constant contact with King Hussein. So much so that when King Hussein came on a visit to the United States last June, this deputy director of the Mossad, Israel's intelligence service, was sent by Prime Minister Rabin to Washington to be on hand to help and advise, if necessary, King Hussein during his own trip to Washington and obviously serve as a constant liaison with Israel. So this is a deep and long-standing relationship, and he happens to be the Israeli that the king trusts most.
It seems not only unusual, but almost unfathomable that somebody from Israeli intelligence should be the closest person to the head of a country that was considered an enemy country.
Oh, Terry, there are many stories in the Naked City. In the Naked City, there are many stories. And in the Middle East, you know, what you see is never what you get. And that's just one example. I mean, here's a man who, the deputy director of the Mossad, of all people, who's had, as we revealed, a 25-year relationship with the King of Jordan. And I think all it tells me is, you know, God knows what else we don't know.
Now, the king had cancer surgery over a year ago. Do you think that that figures into this as well as all the political changes figuring into the story?
I think it does in a minor way. I think he's been thinking about, as one would, under those circumstances, his own mortality, what will be his place in history. I think he very much, I mean, King Hussein and his family have always been probably the most accommodating of the Zionist movement for the last 100 years, and I think, or for the however many years they've ruled Jordan. And so I think that this is actually something that he's always wanted to do, but really didn't feel he could do, and because of how things have evolved here in the last few years, he's finally been able to do it. I think he feels, I sensed in talking to him last week, a real sense of relief. Okay, finally this charade is over. We can have a natural and open relationship with our neighbor. It doesn't mean we're necessarily going to love and embrace each other, but we can have a natural relationship. That's something he kept emphasizing. There is something unnatural about living next to a country and not having any contact with it whatsoever.
How did President Clinton get involved in the negotiations between Jordan and Israel?
Well, President Clinton actually played his hand very deftly. It was a hand, one should always make clear, that was dealt to him by the Israelis and the Jordanians. But the cards he had to play, I think he played quite well. And the main card he had to play was the fact that Jordan has a global debt. It owes the world, world banks, and different governments, $6.5 billion. Well, this is a country with a gross national product annually of only $4.5 billion. So it's a huge per capita debt. And King Hussein needs to get that debt either whittled down or forgiven or rescheduled. Well, we hold, we the United States, about $700 million of that debt. And what all of Jordan's creditors around the world have been telling it is that we're not going to write down your debt, we're not going to reschedule your debt if the Americans, the country, the power that you're closest to, won't do it. So Clinton held the key in many ways to Jordan's future. If he would write down or reschedule Jordan's debt, Jordan could really begin to get out under this huge debt burden. And basically what Clinton did at every stage was dangle debt relief, debt rescheduling, and simply debt cancellation in front of King Hussein if he would first have his brother meet publicly with Shimon Peres, which they did about a year ago, and then if he would engage in true peace negotiations with the Israelis, and finally, if he would meet publicly with Yitzhak Rabin and really openly embrace and engage Israel.
What did Clinton want in return?
I think what Clinton wanted in return was a breakthrough in the Middle East, for which he would get part of the credit. And I think the part of the credit, and one has to underline that, is due to him. You know, a lot of people have written, mindlessly, that somehow, oh, the United States isn't a player in the Middle East anymore because Arafat and Hussein both made peace with Israel without major American mediation. And somehow this reflects badly on the United States. And I think that really misses a fundamental point. And the fundamental point is this: thanks to the Madrid Peace Conference that Secretary of State Baker organized a couple of years ago, which opened the way for the first direct face-to-face peace talks with Israel and the Arab countries, the United States has put itself out of business in many ways. These people can talk directly to one another. That has begun real politics between them, real diplomacy between them. And therefore, to hold American diplomacy in the Middle East today to the standard of Henry Kissinger's 32 shuttles between Syria and Israel in 1974 and say that's the model of American diplomacy is, to me, absurd. It really ignores the evolution of this story and the evolution of this diplomacy.
What are the most important parts of the agreement between Israel and Jordan? What does each side get? What does each side give up?
There's only one important part of this agreement, and it's the public handshake between King Hussein and Yitzhak Rabin. The rest is minor details: border this, border that, water sharing, tourism. The bottom line, the big picture, is that Israel and Jordan have come out of the closet and are going to be openly engaged in friendly, neighborly relations. And that's the headline, and the rest is just details.
My guest is New York Times reporter Tom Friedman. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist Tom Friedman. He co-wrote a New York Times special report about the secret talks between Israel and Jordan, which led to last week's accord. So now Syria is the only country in the Middle East that hasn't made peace with Israel. What does it look like to you on that front?
Well, I can argue two ways. I can argue why Syria is not going to follow up with Israel, and I can argue why Syria has to follow up with Israel. And I can't tell you, I'd be loath to predict at this point, Terry, which will evolve.
Can you give us both sides of that story?
Okay, I'll give you both sides. First, you know, why I'm dubious that Syria will follow up. Because I am not sure President Assad of Syria has really fully gotten his mind around the idea that to make peace with Israel, to get what he wants out of the Israelis, he's going to have to do every bit of what Sadat did, of what King Hussein did, and maybe a little bit more given the greater depth of enmity historically between Syria and Israel. In other words, he's going to have to come to the White House. He's going to have to shake the hand of the Israeli prime minister. He's going to have to say the words peace with the Jewish state. He's going to have to stand at attention for the Israeli national anthem. Now, you know, maybe he is ready to do that. I would be loath to say he would never do that after everything we've seen here in the last couple of years. But given his sort of Arabist credentials, given his history, given the fact that he leads a country whose governments only ideology and raison d'etre has been really the Arab nationalist conflict with Israel. I am loath to predict that he is really ready to step up to that ball. At the same time, the other side of the argument says he's basically isolated. He no longer has Russia as a superpower ally. His best friends in the world are Iran and North Korea and Libya, and those are not great friends in this world of global economic competition. He's lost Jordan as a card to play. He's lost Yasser Arafat as a card to play. And, you know, King Hafez Assad of Syria always thought of himself as the bus driver of the Arab bus. And he thought in the back seat were Hussein and Arafat and the Lebanese and all the other Arabs, and that one day he would drive the bus to the station and he would make peace on behalf of everyone, and it would be a peace that he could live with and not one that involved too much degradation or real embracing of the Jewish state. And lo and behold, he's walking down the street and suddenly sees a bus go by, and who's driving but Yasser A. Arafat? And, you know, and it must have just turned his head. And then he walks down the street, you know, a few more miles, and another bus goes by. And who's driving but King Hussein of Jordan, you know? And he's looking at them and saying, you know, you didn't call, you didn't write, not a card, not a letter, okay? And he is one very isolated hombre right now. And that is going to put enormous pressure on him because he has no military option.
You know, last night at President Clinton's press conference, he said that he was encouraged that Syria televised the ceremony between Jordan and Israel in Washington, D.C. Do you interpret that as a sign?
Yeah, I mean, again, that we would put in the first category of why one might be optimistic, you know, and maybe Assad is preparing the ground for his people. But I would argue that he's really doing both. I mean, he's keeping his options open. On the one hand, he's laying down a predicate for making peace with Israel and slowly, gradually preparing his public. On the other hand, though, you know, he's still holding back any real kind of normalization with Israel or any kind of secret negotiation, certainly, that we've even had any inkling of. So, you know, I think everything you see out of Syria suggests both scenarios are possible, one that he could hold out for a while and the other that he'll inevitably fall into line.
As you wrote in the article, King Hussein and Yitzhak Rabin are men who were present at the creation of the conflict between their countries nearly a half century ago. Do you find it interesting and even symbolic that all the leaders presiding over this emerging Middle East peace are older men? They're kind of at the end of their leadership. It's not the new generation that's doing this.
That's true. I mean, partly, though, that is a function of the fact that these guys refuse to give up power. That's a large part of it. But I also think it's men too long at war who really see their careers coming to an end and would like to bury this thing. But, of course, it isn't universally true. Israel was led by a Likud government for the past, you know, decade or so before Rabin came into power, and they were also old men, and they had no interest. In fact, some of them were very much young men also, and they had no interest in these kinds of arrangements. So it really depends who's in power, which old men. The history of the Middle East, Terry, has for the last 46 years, since the 1948 war, been, in my opinion, the history of the wrong men in the right place at the wrong time. And for the first time, we have the right men in the right place at the right time. And that's why we have peace in the Middle East.
In the past, you've really been a skeptic about a Middle East peace. Are you still a skeptic?
My feeling is, you know, I knew what the parties had to do, but I deeply doubted that they would do it. For years, I began every talk on the Middle East with a joke about this very pious Jew named Goldberg who wanted to win the lottery. And Goldberg would go to synagogue every weekend and pray, God, what would be so bad, God, if I won the lottery? I've been such a pious Jew all my life. And the lottery would come, and Goldberg wouldn't win. And this would go on week after week, month after month. Goldberg would go to synagogue and say, God, I have been such a pious Jew. What would be so bad if I won the lottery? And the lottery would come and Goldberg wouldn't win. Finally, one Saturday, Goldberg's in synagogue and he says, God, what do I have to do to win the lottery? And the heavens parted and the voice of God came down and said, Goldberg, give me a chance. Buy a ticket. And in many ways, that story always reminded me of the Arabs and Israelis, each one kind of crying to the heavens, God, please deliver my side. But no one was really ready to buy a ticket. No one was really ready to step up to the fundamental compromises and sacrifices that would be required for peace, the sorts of fundamental compromises and sacrifices we've seen in the Rabin Arafat negotiations and in the Rabin King Hussein negotiations. And so really, in my opinion, the way I like to say it is the sides have finally bought a ticket. But I have to tell you, Terry, I came by my skepticism honestly. I came by it by covering this conflict for the last 20 years. And I can only come by my optimism the same way. And that is after I see this thing work on the ground. But for the moment, I'm certainly a lot more optimistic than I was before.
I have one last question for you. I'm sure a lot of your readers, as I am, are wondering, how come you've been writing about money and world finance lately? It's an interesting beat for you. You've been making it really quite readable and interesting, but what are you doing there?
Where are you going? I'll tell you what I'm doing there. Basically, the publisher of the New York Times has felt that the most important story of the world in the coming years and already is the intersection between foreign policy and economic policy. That if you want to write seriously about foreign policy these days, you can't just write about Bosnia and Haiti. You've got to understand the intersection between trade and politics, between global economic movements and international diplomacy. And basically what they've asked me to do in covering international economics is bring these two subjects that have often almost always been covered separately together. And it's been very interesting for me, Terry, because what I've discovered is that there's a lot of reporters out there covering diplomacy who don't know anything about economics, and I would have put myself very much in that category. There are a lot of reporters out there who've been covering trade and global economics, and they don't know anything about foreign policy and diplomacy. And what I've discovered is that the real story today of so much of the Clinton foreign policy and so much of foreign policy in the world today is the intersection between global economic policy and diplomacy. And what I've also discovered is that when you stand at that intersection, there's nobody else there. So it's great. So don't tell anybody.
Oh,
I've
no.
I've got this intersection all to myself. So just keep it between you and me.
Sure.
It's been a lot of fun.
Well, maybe we can make that the subject of a future talk. I hope
Anytime.
So. Thanks so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Tom Friedman is a reporter for the New York Times. He's the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book From Beirut to Jerusalem. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we talk with South African writer Sindhuwe Magona. Her memoir, To My Children's Children, is about her struggle as a single mother raising three children under the apartheid system. Magona now lives in New York, where she's a translator at the UN. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews Watergate, the five-part documentary series on the Discovery Channel, narrated by Daniel Schur. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Israeli army has taken the unusual step of apologizing for the bombing of a house in southern Lebanon in which at least seven civilians were killed. NPR's Paul Miller has more from Jerusalem.
An Israeli army spokeswoman said an attack by an Israeli airplane on the house had been a mistake. According to the Israelis, the plane was involved in a raid on Lebanese guerrilla positions in South Lebanon when a bomb went off course. The Israeli army said innocent civilians are not the target of its air raids, and it expressed sorrow. Israel has been involved in an ongoing battle with Hezbollah and other Lebanese guerrilla groups in southern Lebanon. Some analysts have predicted an Israeli offensive there in response to recent bombings of Jewish targets in Buenos Aires and London. Others say Israel will show restraint because it does not want to jeopardize peace talks with Jordan or Syria. Today's apology may have had a similar motivation. I'm Paul Miller in Jerusalem.
A published report says the FBI is trying to find out if there is a conspiracy to stir up violence at abortion clinics. The New York Times reports Attorney General Janet Reno ordered the new probe hours after the shooting deaths of a doctor and his escort outside an abortion clinic a week ago in Florida. The paper says FBI field officers got a confidential notice listing anti-abortion activists who've signed a justifiable homicide declaration. It advocates the killing of doctors who perform abortions. Catholic priest David Trosh is on the list. He's been suspended by the Vatican for his belief, but he told the Times there is no conspiracy. Prosecutors and police in Los Angeles are reportedly trying to build a case that O.J. Simpson had stalked his ex-wife Nicole Brown Simpson before she was murdered. UPI's Pat Nason reports.
So far, prosecutors have not addressed the question, if O.J. Simpson killed Nicole Simpson, what was the motive? The Los Angeles Times reports police detectives have been interviewing people who knew Nicole Simpson and have taken custody of tapes from her telephone answering machine, apparently looking for evidence that Simpson stalked his ex-wife, culminating with her murder on June 12th. Typically, evidence of prior bad behavior is not admissible in court unless such prior acts can be used to show motive. Simpson has pleaded not guilty to two counts of first-degree murder. Pat Nason, Los Angeles.
The cholera epidemic that killed thousands of Rwandan refugees in Zairean camps is apparently over. Relief workers say increasing supplies of clean water have slowed down the number of cases and deaths, but they point to dysentery as the new illness to fear. A UN refugee official says for every refugee that has cholera, two dysentery cases are admitted to clinics. Stock prices closed lower today. The Dow Jones Industrials fell 27 points to close at 3,765. This is NPR. An American television crew was being forced to leave Haiti. Three American journalists, a Haitian interpreter, and a Haitian driver were detained Sunday after shooting footage of the deserted airport in Port-au-Prince. The Americans were released, but the Haitians are still being held. The journalists, one of whom is a correspondent for the McNeil Lear NewsHour on PBS, will be driven to the border with the Dominican Republic. Serbia has cut ties with the Bosnian Serbs over the breakaway group's continued refusal to sign a peace plan. The Bosnian Serbs have suggested a referendum on the peace plan is the only way to deal with the issue. The BBC's Paul Adams reports.
So much abuse has been heaped on the plan and its authors that the outcome of the referendum is a foregone conclusion. Unless something very remarkable happens between now and the end of the month, the plan will go the way of its predecessors. The members of the Assembly already know this, and are being disingenuous when they argue that only the people can decide on an issue of such gravity. A sense of renewed isolation has fallen over Pale in the past week as the Bosnian Serbs prepare to face a world bereft of friends. They've called on the Serbian and Montenegrin parliaments to declare the unity of all Serbian lands and have asked the Serbs of Croatia to back them up in their request. It seems a forlorn hope, more a gesture of defiance to the Serbian president, Slobodan Milosevic, than anything else.
Paul Adams reporting. Transportation Secretary Federico Peña is calling a summit to improve railroad safety. His announcement comes one day after an Amtrak train derailed in western New York State. 110 people were hurt. Peña told CBS today he'll gather officials from the railroad industry with the federal and state regulatory agencies. The investigation into the derailment is still going on. Investigators are looking at the condition of the tracks and the chance of mechanical failure. Peña says it could take months to find out what happened. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sindhuwe Magona raised three children as a single mother under South Africa's apartheid system. She supported her children by working as a maid and then as a teacher. She faced constant absurdities and indignities. Here's one example. During the years that her children stayed home from school as part of the black students' boycott of the apartheid system of education, Magona was working at an elite private school teaching her native African language to white students. Her dream was to get a good education for herself and her children. In her early 40s, after she became an activist in the South African women's movement, Magona won a scholarship to study at Columbia University. After moving to America, she started to write. Two of her books have recently been published in the States, her memoir, To My Children's Children, and her collection of short stories, Living, Loving, and Lying Awake at Night. When Magona finally got the university education she dreamed of, it brought its own surprises and discomforts.
You know, when I was at Columbia, I looked at my class. I was pushing 40, and there were young people there who were 21. There was a South African white woman there who had finished school and worked as a social worker for about 5 years or more and then decided that she wanted to do her master's. She was 25 or 27, something like that. And I kept wondering what happened to my 15 years that I was sitting in the same class with her.
Did your children stay in South Africa when you came to New York?
Yes, they stayed in South Africa when I came to Columbia.
And how old were they at the time?
They were in there, you know, one was about 14, 16, and 18, something like that.
How did you feel about leaving them behind? Was that a difficult decision to make, weighing the pros and cons? What? Let me ask you this. What were the pros and cons in your mind about whether you should go to Colombia and leave them behind or stay in South Africa and pass up this incredible opportunity?
I have learned, among other things, to be selfish. Because I had to, you know, I had brought up the children on my own, I had always promised myself that one day, and I'd done all this studying, virtually about 10 years of my life, you know, studying by correspondence. First, you know, the last 2 years of high school, and then I did a general certificate of education through London University by correspondence too, as well as the last 2 years of high school. And then I did a degree through the University of South Africa, also by correspondence. I had promised myself that one day, I would go and experience, give myself the experience of being a real student in a real university setting, okay? And this was going to happen when the youngest child had finished high school. Well, if I was waiting for my children to finish high school, I was going to be 80 and gray or dead before that happened. And also just in terms of the relief I needed, I was under such, you know, turmoil. There was such turmoil in my life because of this, you know, lack of education for the children. But really, I would have gone out of my mind if I hadn't left South Africa at that time.
Who did you leave your children with?
With one of my sisters and my mother.
And did they support your decision to go?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. You see, child rearing with us is really more communal than in white homes. Even if I had not left South Africa, it's not unheard of that one of your child will go and live with an aunt or with the grandmother. Not at all.
So when you got to Columbia, you were so, you wanted an education so badly and you'd worked against such odds to get an education through correspondence schools. How did Columbia compare to what you were hoping for?
in some ways, it was, you know, it was good, but there was, you know, when you look forward to something and you get there, and it's not as rigorous as you were, you know, there was a kind of a let down. And I think it was because also that I was a much older student, and the issues we were dealing with as students were things that I had negotiated for myself, you know, a decade before, you know what I mean? You know, so for me, the academic program was not as challenging as I had thought, but there were other challenges, believe me.
Like what?
Like suddenly finding yourself, I had a studio on campus. And this big trauma, a woman who is 37-year-old woman, this is the first time she sleeps in a room by herself.
You're talking about yourself?
Yes.
So you had a studio apartment, you were living alone, and you were totally unused to living alone.
I had never shared that much space. Just by myself. I had never closed a door or locked a door and been inside, and it was night, and gone to bed, and there was nobody in the near vicinity, like in the room next door or in the same room. And it didn't matter if I woke up the next day or not. If I died in that studio, it suddenly occurred to me, nobody would know. Nobody would care. I've never been so scared in my life.
What made you decide to stay in the United States?
The job at the UN. And the opportunity it meant.
Your job at the UN is translating.
Yes, but it also meant that I would move my children from a situation where their schooling had come to an end, and here they would resume their education.
Oh, so you brought them to the States with you?
Oh yes, that was the reason. That was the main reason I wanted a job outside of South Africa, so that I could take my children and they could get their childhood back, and there would be children, they would be going to school, and one day there would be adults who had trained to do some jobs.
Well, what was it like for them to go back to school, but in the United States, especially after having spent years not going to school?
Oh, it was so hard. It was very hard.
Where did they go to school? Was it a public school in New York?
Yeah. One was already too old. I mean, they were all too old for their classes.
Uh-huh.
So, but one was definitely, the eldest was now 21, so she had to do she did the GED.
Mm-hmm.
The younger two were what, 17 and 18 or something, or 18 and 19, something like 17 and 18. And there was a school called McBurney's on the west side. It has closed shop, unfortunately. It ran out of funds, a private school. And, you know, they helped me. They took them, although, as I said, they were much older than the average student there.
So in a way, they were going through what you went through when you went to Columbia.
Yes.
Being at a different age and stage in their lives than the rest of the students.
That's right. It was very hard for all of them.
So what are your children doing now?
The younger two are back in South Africa. The youngest child is working for a finance company and is thinking of, well, he's not thinking, he's planning to, you know, he has a college degree, but he wants to do his master's now, and he's looking for a scholarship. The middle child dropped out of school. She didn't finish. She took up acting and da-da-da. She's back in South Africa working as a manager for a shop, you know, much like Gap here, but it's only for men. It's a men clothing shop.
Mm-hmm.
And the eldest child is here. She works as a social worker.
Were you sorry the two of your children went back to South Africa?
No. You see, my idea, what I had promised myself was that after my husband left me, was that I would be father to my children. Because in my mind then, fathers provided for their children, disciplined their children, went to work every day, and made sure they went to school. I would be father to my children. In other words, they would never want to go to school, and I would then have to shamefacedly tell them that I didn't have money to send them to school. I would be there for them. But I had always promised myself, because, you know, after you make all these mistakes, like having children at 18, 19, and by age 23, you have three children, which is what happened to me. I realized then what I had cheated myself out of. I did not have a young adulthood. And I promised myself that young adulthood when I reached my 40s. And so I looked after my children. I did what I thought was a responsible job, you know, being with them and making sure that they had a childhood and that they would have a future. But I always told them, and I told myself, that there would come a time when they would be on their own. I wasn't going to be mother to them for the rest of their lives. I was very much looking forward to my 40s, because the youngest would be 18 and I would kiss them goodbye. So when, you know, when we, I brought them here, I sat down with each child to ask if they wanted to come here. This was this opportunity. But if they didn't want to go to school, they were not coming here. And the understanding was that after they finished their first degree, they were on their own.
My guest is South African writer Sindhuwe Magona. She now lives in New York. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with South African writer Sindhuwe Magona. Have you been back since the end of apartheid?
Oh, I went back. I went back in April because it just was something that I knew I had to witness. I had to be part of. I had to be there to see, you know, to see it happen.
So you voted?
I didn't.
You didn't vote?
No.
Why not?
I didn't think... You know, I didn't think this was a real vote. I knew the ANC was going to win. Everybody told me this a year or 2 years ago. And so it just felt like kind of false for me to go and think I was voting for anybody because it was such a foregone conclusion who was going to win. No, I didn't vote. You know, because of the moment in history for South Africans, the white government had to go. This I understood. And another group had to come in. And for it to be the ANC and not the PAC and not Inkatha and not anybody else is because of history. The ANC is the party that has opposed apartheid for the longest time. The PAC is a splinter group that broke away from the ANC. And so I knew that as people in that country, we were going to vote the ANC in. And not because of what it was promising. Virtually, if you looked at what their tickets, the ANC, the government, they were promising the same things. Virtually, to the last letter. I am not, you know, I'm not a member of any of the political parties, so I was free to vote for anybody I chose. I just didn't feel that this was a real vote, and I think in 5 years I will vote.
Now that there's a new government in South Africa, Nelson Mandela is the president, apartheid is over, do you have any interest in returning to live there?
Yes and no. I would love to go back to South Africa. But as long as I still have to work, working in South Africa is not something I'm looking forward to. At my age, I've been working at the UN now just over 10 years, and I have just about 10 years more to work. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I've worked in South Africa longer than 10 years. I have nothing to show for that. Absolutely nothing. I have, except the three children who are still alive. They're adults now. I have no pension. I have nothing in South Africa. You see, the job I have here gives me a feeling of some security that when I'm old and, you know, and gray, I will have a plate of food on my table. I will have a table to put a plate on and food on that plate. This is not something that South Africa taught me to believe. I have not worked in South Africa and then felt that because I was working in that country, my life was secure. You see what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And going back to South Africa always is traumatic for me.
Why is it traumatic for you to go back to South
Africa? South Africa is a country that has brutalized me, stultified me, denied, dehumanized, bronzed me, as I say. And, you know, that will take a lot of healing. And now I've acquired a rather expensive habit, writing. And I love my writing, the doing of it, okay? And as someone said... You know, a writer needs a room of her own. And I cannot be quite sure that I would have the space in South Africa to do that writing.
Well, it's interesting you should say that because one of the things that upset you when you first came to New York to study at Columbia was that you had a room of your own.
Yes, I've gotten used to it
now. Right, because then you were afraid if you died overnight, no one would care, no one would notice, no one would care in the morning.
Only the stench would warn the neighbors that, hey, something went wrong there. This was a frightening thought. You know, in South Africa, we hear of those things from people who work in domestic work or in the paper, if you read the papers, that, you know, this little old woman who lived by herself died and then the neighbors noticed the stench. And it had always puzzled us how, you could be dead and nobody knew. Because we live such open lives, you know, into we're always into each other's houses all the time. That you are sick and you die and nobody knows. Like in my language, there is a curse. May you die alone, because nobody should die alone.
Well, you know, you have a couple of memoirs, a book of short stories. Your memoirs are written in the form of a grandmother talking to her grandchildren. Do you actually have grandchildren yet?
Not yet.
So why did you use that form to write your personal story?
Because I was not a writer. My big aim was to write a book, you know, in my life, to write a book. And then when I finally sat down, I realized I didn't know what book I was going to write. And I would start a short story, and by the second paragraph, I would see my life there. And nobody had taught me that you could disguise facts and make them fiction. I didn't know anything. And then I thought, well, since I always seem to be writing about myself, maybe I should write about myself. That was one hurdle. Once I went over that hurdle, then I said to myself, but why should you write about yourself? You're not famous. You're nobody. Who will want to read any book about you? Then I thought, oh, well, maybe not now. Maybe in 100 years' time. I was convinced South Africa would change. I didn't write this book for today. To my children's children, it's not a book that I thought was important for now. But I certainly thought that all the things we did, all the things we believed in, all the things, you know, how we grew up, how we lived as ordinary human beings, somebody will want to know.
Sindhuwe Magona is the author of two books recently published in the States by Interlink, a memoir called To My Children's Children, and a book of short stories called Living, Loving, and Lying Awake at Night. She spells her last name M-A-G-O-N-A, Magona. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, the Serbs have apparently cut loose, the Bosnian Serbs. We'll have a report on how serious, how real that may be. We'll have a report on gang efforts to intimidate witnesses, which are taking place around the country. Well, there's the testimony to that effect on Capitol Hill today. There is a loophole in the Brady Bill. It applies to gun dealers, but there are other legitimate ways to buy guns. We have 2 days on patrol with police in Baltimore, that Robert Siegel piece, and a really wonderful piece. And we'll be talking about presidential props, like the president used last night in his news conference.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This Sunday, the Discovery Channel begins showing a mini-series co-produced for the Discovery Channel and the BBC. Even though it's a British import, this lengthy program is about a quintessentially American subject, which is also the one-word title of the series, Watergate. TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
What did the president know, and when did he know it?
That was Howard Baker's famous question at the Senate Watergate hearings in 1973. This new documentary answers that question more clearly and completely than anything else I've seen on TV. But which way you approach this Watergate series as a viewer depends upon a slightly different question. Namely, what did you know about Watergate, and when did you know it? If you're old enough to have lived through Watergate, as I did, then the names of Dean, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and Liddy are almost as evocative as those of John, Paul, George, and Ringo. The cast of characters was huge but unforgettable, just like the events themselves. The nightly headlines, the sudden speeches, the Saturday Night Massacre, and the Watergate hearings, where we first learned about Nixon's expletive-deleted tapes. Finally, a president resigned and was pardoned, rather than face impeachment. If you sat through Watergate the first time around, watching it unfold again in this fascinating 5-hour documentary is a little like watching Watergate's greatest hits. But it's also like a sequel, because producer Norma Percy, producer-director Paul Mitchell, and director Mick Gold conducted 40 new interviews for their Watergate series, including ones with John Dean, Bob Haldeman, and G. Gordon Liddy. If you're young enough to be learning about the Watergate scandal in depth for the first time, there's no better place to start. And if you know all the president's men by heart, this series will still surprise you. It even surprised John Dean by handing him, on camera, a copy of a memo he thought had been destroyed decades ago. It's a sheet of paper on which Haldeman's initials are shown approving the Watergate break-in, and Dean's reaction to it is priceless.
If Haldeman knew about this, there is no doubt in my mind that Richard Nixon knew about this, because everything that Haldeman knew, he knew for the sake of Richard Nixon. And it's just inconceivable to me that this type of information, which Nixon loved, would not be shared with him.
Another highlight of Watergate, the series, not the scandal, is the behind-the-scenes story of the Senate Watergate Committee's discovery of the secret White House tapes. Prosecutors Sam Dash and Jim Hamilton were the first to learn about the taping system and went straight out to tell their star witness John Dean, but not before putting him and his wife Maureen to a little test. The voices you will hear are those of Jim Hamilton, followed by John Dean.
And I can remember that Mo and John, I believe, was sitting on a couch, and I was standing by the fireplace, and I did that on purpose so I could gauge John's reaction. I was watching him very intently, and Sam told him, and I never will forget it. John broke into this huge smile, this beaming smile.
I couldn't have been more elated. I said, Sam, I said, everything I've told you, you're now going to find a record for.
Daniel Shore, currently of National Public Radio and formerly of Richard Nixon's enemies list, provides the narration for Watergate and does a great job with what has to be his most ironic freelance job ever. The commentary, though, is saved for others, including classic remarks by David Brinkley and John Chancellor the night they reported the resignations and firings that came to be known as the Saturday Night Massacre.
An investigator appointed to investigate scandals was fired because he insisted on investigating scandals.
In my career as a correspondent, I never thought I'd be announcing these things.
And in my career as a TV critic, I never thought I'd be watching a Watergate documentary this good. Don't miss it.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Sue Spolin, with Jewel Bracey and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Mark Tullis. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, some of the people behind current hit films. We'll hear from Andrew Bergman, director of the new comedy It Could Happen to You, and one of the film's co-stars, Stanley Tucci. Also, Jamie Lee Curtis is now starring in True Lies. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.